by the third week of April in 1970. Soldiers of the Trinidad Regiment were sailing gunboats into the Gulf of Paria with weapons loaded and a decision already made. They were not going to war with a foreign power. They were going to join one.
8 years after independence, something had broken open in Trinidad. Not suddenly, not cleanly. The break had been building since the Union Jack came down, and the red, black, and white flag of a new republic went up on August 31st, 1962.
What had changed that night was the flag. What had not changed was who owned the land, the oil refineries, the banks, and the sugar companies. Who controlled those things on August 31st, 1962, still controlled them on the 1st of September.
The names at the top of the corporate masthead were still mostly European. The names in the unemployment lines were not. What no one in the streets of Port of Spain could see was how far beyond the island the watching had already extended. By 1970, unemployment among young black Trinidadians had exceeded 20%. The oil industry that made the island rich employed relatively few of them. The banks that held their savings were majority owned by Canadian and British interests.
The phrase circulating through Port of Spain that February was not borrowed wholesale from American civil rights rhetoric, though the timing connected the two movements. What Trinidadians were saying was more specific. They were saying independence without economic power is not independence.
They were saying, we are the majority in name only. The match was struck in Canada in January of 1970. Black students at Sir George Williams University in Montreal occupied the university's computer lab in protest against a professor they accused of racial bias in grading.
The protest became a confrontation. Property was damaged. Trinidadian and West Indian students were arrested and faced criminal charges in a foreign court. When the news reached Port of Spain, the response was not abstract. These were Trinidadian young people standing before a Canadian magistrate for demanding fair treatment at a foreign institution. Something in that image, the Caribbean child processed through a colonial legal framework, shook loose 8 years of restrained fury. On February 26, 1970, the National Joint Action Committee marched 10,000 people through the streets of Port of Spain. The organization had been founded weeks earlier.
Its leader was a young man named Geddes Granger, who later took the name Macandal Daga, drawn from Haitian revolutionary history. He claimed as his own inheritance. He was 25 years old. He did not need to raise his voice to fill a crowd. His argument was not complicated. The people who worked the land and the oil fields of Trinidad should own a proportionate stake in what they produced. The government of Prime Minister Eric Williams had delivered political sovereignty in 1962. It had not delivered economic sovereignty. The two were not the same thing. The marches grew. Week after week through February and into March, crowds moved through Port of Spain. They marched to Arima. They marched to the edges of the Sugar Belt. They carried portraits of Stokely Carmichael, the Trinidadian-born activist who had given the phrase Black Power its modern political charge and who had been banned from returning to his own country. They draped the public statues of Queen Victoria and Christopher Columbus in black cloth and demanded their removal from the squares of a country those figures had never liberated. In March, the statues were removed. Eric Williams was not a simple man to oppose. Before he entered politics, he had written the definitive scholarly text on the economics of Caribbean slavery, capitalism and slavery, a work that laid out in precise academic language exactly the argument the protesters were making in the streets. He understood the material case. He had made it himself. But Williams, in 1970, was also a prime minister, 8 years into power, dependent on foreign investment, managing a government whose stability rested partly on the same economic arrangements the movement wanted dismantled. He watched the marches grow. He delayed. He calculated. His private reasoning in those weeks is not fully documented. What is documented is what happened when the army moved. Lieutenant Rex LaSalle commanded a regiment whose members had watched the marches, heard the speeches, and reached their own conclusion. On April 21, 1970, LaSalle's soldiers mutinied. They loaded weapons, boarded two naval vessels in the Gulf of Paria, and announced their intention to join the revolution in the streets of Port of Spain. They did not simply walk off their posts. They sailed armed boats toward the capital of their own country. The words Eric Williams chose were not the words the revolutionaries would have chosen. He declared a state of emergency. He suspended civil liberties. He authorized the arrest of movement leaders, including Makandal Daga, who was taken into custody that night. The same machinery of surveillance that had monitored Caribbean political movements for decades, long before anyone in those streets had ever marched, had been running the entire time. What Williams did not do, and historians have noted this carefully, was order fire on the mutinying soldiers. Why he held back has never been fully explained. Some historians argue pure political calculation. Shooting Trinidadian soldiers who had sided with a popular uprising would have destroyed whatever legitimacy his government still held with the population. Others suggest the negotiations happening in those hours involved undocumented assurances. The full record of those conversations has not been released. The crisis had an audience beyond Trinidad. American warships appeared in the waters off the island during the peak days of April. This is documented. What their orders were, whether positioned to observe, to evacuate American civilians, or to intervene if the Williams government fell, remains classified. The Cold War logic of 1970 was straightforward. A black power movement in an oil-producing Caribbean island, at a moment when the movement's most prominent international figure had been declared persona non grata by the host government, was precisely the kind of instability that Washington tracked with immediate attention. The ships were there. Their instructions have not been released. The mutiny ended without a shot fired in combat. The soldiers were surrounded by loyal forces and compelled to surrender. Lieutenant LaSalle and the men who sailed with him were arrested, tried by court-martial, and convicted. They served prison terms. In the decades since, several have spoken publicly about what they believe they were doing. Not betraying Trinidad, but attempting to finish what independence had left undone. The state of emergency lasted until October. When it ended, the political landscape had shifted in ways both visible and subterranean. Visible, the movement had forced Williams to accelerate the nationalization of key industries. Within 4 years, the government took majority control of the oil sector. The foreign-owned companies that had operated with near-total autonomy since before independence found the terms beneath them permanently altered. This was not given freely. It was extracted under pressure by people who had decided that 8 years of patience was enough. What was less visible was the cost. The movement's organizational structure was broken by the arrests. The NJAC never regained the concentrated mass energy of those 56 days. The revolution as a sustained street force did not succeed in its total transformation. This is not unusual in history. Boukman died before Haiti's independence. Sam Sharp was executed after the Baptist War. The people who force historical change frequently pay for it in personal freedom, and the transformation they achieve is never exactly the transformation they envisioned. What remained was different from what existed before it. A generation of Trinidadians who had stood in those streets carried the knowledge that they had moved a government, not toppled it, moved it. That distinction between revolution and negotiated rupture has shaped how Caribbean historians have understood 1970 ever since. There is one document from those days that appears in few mainstream histories. A State Department cable, declassified years later under the Freedom of Information Act, describes the American assessment of the Williams government during the crisis. The cable notes with evident relief that the situation has been contained and that the government has demonstrated sufficient resolve. What the cable does not contain is any note of what the people in those streets were asking for. Their demands are absent. Their names are absent. They appear only as a problem that had been managed. That is how the 1970 revolution entered the historical record outside of Trinidad. A contained problem, a narrowly averted crisis, a government that held inside Trinidad, the memory is not contained. It does not always appear in school curricula or tourism brochures, but ask the people who were young in 1970 or whose parents were, and the story comes out differently. Not a problem. A moment, a 56-day window, when the people of an island 8 years out of colonialism decided to find out how much of their liberation was real. The soldiers who mutinied served their sentences and came home. The movement's leaders rebuilt their lives. The oil was nationalized. The statues came down. And every April, in Trinidad, there are people who remember what it felt like when the army sailed the wrong way, or the right way, depending on who is telling the story. Toward the capital of a country, still learning what it meant to be free. the question history has not settled, and that those classified cables will not answer, is this: did the movement fail because it was stopped, or did it succeed because it could not be erased?